So we'll launch into aquaculture with our emphasis always being on design. Aquaculture is the rearing of organisms in water, and it's got a subsection, mariculture. But still, it's all aquaculture. And the water medium has all those advantages which you know about, in that it's a three-dimensional medium, that animals don't need to support their weight very efficiently in it, that it has a lot of nutrients already in solution as against soil, and so it, potentially we get yields 10 or 20 times greater than that we get on adjoining land. Now, it can be many thousands of times greater also. And in fact, we're achieving such yields. Also, to say about aquaculture, it's the fastest growing and most innovative and least stuffy area of culture, because it doesn't have as yet an aquaculture department in the government. it's all out there. People are being very innovative, and they don't have any old models to go on, so it's a nice area to work in. And the other thing to say about it is aquacultural products are rapidly overhauling wild-caught products in every area where aquaculture now operates. That is, if you take salmon fisheries in North America, the cultivated salmon are just about at level with wild-caught salmon. So it will probably replace wild-caught foods in its area. And then, like all other cultures, there are two approaches. Well, perhaps another thing to say about it is you've got to be organic in aquaculture. Many of your organisms are very susceptible, particularly to pesticides. So you can't be too dirty in aquaculture. Organisms are too delicate. So that's an advantageous thing about it. In fact, particularly with some of the crustacea, like the yabbies, very small amounts of pesticides will kill them. They're more indicator species, and the prawns. So you've got to be a little better manager than you have on land cultures. Although you can undertake some disease control, it's usually very short-term and very innocuous material that rapidly disperses, like iodine or salt or something like that. So it's not such a bad culture as land culture. Now, there are two categories of things grown, the plants and animals. And almost all books on aquaculture deal with animals, and almost all of them deal specifically with fish. So we're not going to do that. We're going to deal with plants and a broad range of animal species. Now, the plants, you can sort of cut them up into use types. You can do a little table for yourself if you want to. Like there's sort of staple foods in aquaculture. There's root crop, seed crop, greens, and special crop. So that's use types, and you can cut them up then into their physical attributes, I suppose. Or where they go in the water, and there's the floating, anchored, that is, they've got their roots in the mud, but the plant floats on top. Emergent, which is probably the largest class of things we grow, and submerged. And there's very few forms of submerged free floating things in the sea, but they're not much cultured. So you can put your plants in that sort of matrix. Now, at staple plants in the water, probably the most important one is the taro, which is being increasingly cultured in Australia. There's several colocasias. Esculenta is a common form. There are about 1,100 varieties. And taro can be dry or wet. And wetland taro is grown in paddy or flooded fields, and dryland taro is grown heavily mulched in damp situations. So taro is a very good understory plant in high rainfall orchards too. But it's commonly grown in water. Do you know the plant at all, taro? Well, it's being sold widely now in Sydney. It's a large root crop. I'll draw it for you. Has a very large, you've seen it somewhere, I'll bet you. Very large leaf like this. The stem enters here. And it has a very big bulbous root, about roughly that shape. And the water level's here, usually, and it grows out of the water. And it has, then it forms little subroots. It sort of carves off around the crown here, and these little guys come up. So when you dig a taro, you get four or five little ones, and you can just cut the tops off the taros like a disc with the leaves on it, and then at the first join here, you cut that off and you replant that piece. So when you harvest a taro, you replant it. This piece here. So it's handy like that. It's vegetatively propagated. You push those little discs back in the mud and away they go again. Usually they're just tied up in bundles as you harvest and left in the mud, and then they put little thick roots out and then you spread them out. And it's about the same quality of food as potato. Probably not quite as good as potato, but it's widely eaten. It's a staple food throughout Oceania and, in fact, parts of China. And it's you use it as you would potatoes. You boil it, bake it. But it has an additional thing you do. It goes to poi, which is a ferment. It's a yeast ferment of cooked and pounded taro. And that has vitamin V, B vitamins, which is useful out on islands. One of the sources of B vitamins on islands. So that's taro. So that's one of your staples. It's an emerging crop. Not so much a staple, but a starchy food is lotus. Oh, taro yields, by the way, extremely high. It's if you care for a little taro patch at your back door, five roots will give you about 150 pounds of taro. So it's a very high yield and very expensive crop. So it's commercially a very good crop, as well as being a high source of starch.
What do you mean it's expensive?
That is, it's much higher per kilo, say, than potatoes, three or four times more paid for it than potatoes. And poi is a very big world trade item. It's poi is being flown across the Pacific in all directions. In sealed plastic bags of fermented poi. If you've tasted poi, it tastes like, it looks like pink chewing gum, it tastes like acidic pink chewing gum. Taro has little spicules of, I'll think of it in a minute, oxalic acid in the leaves and actually in the root. So you can't eat it raw. You can't even put a piece of leaf in your mouth because it burns and these spicules stick in your tongue and your cheeks. And you can't carry it on a naked back for the same reason. I've tried to do that once. That's the elephant's ears is Alocasia. It's in the same family of Araceae. Macrorhiza. I never know how to spell the I did two R's or two I. Yeah, I know the IZA bit, but there's two somethings. Two R's, I think. Alocasia macrorhiza. That's called also called Ufi. That's the staple food of the Fijians. And it's well, that's grown in damp places. It's rarely water cultured. And it can be grown out on dry land systems. Yeah. That's right. And there's konjac and yatia. They're all in this family. all different genera. Somewhere in the world, in all wet tropics, they're either growing one of these four. And they're all in the family Araceae. So when you're in 60-inch rainfall, like you are up at Billingen or north of there, you can grow any of those out on land or in gullies. When you're in low rainfall, say below 40-inch rainfalls, most of them need a paddy field situation.
Do they choke up waterways?
No, they only spread by vegetative means. You've got to cut pieces off and put them in. There's no case where they're actually known to spread. I've never seen a taro seed. I think they seed. And there may be a few ancient forms that seed. And certainly I've never seen oofy seeds. Oofy is the thing that you use in hurricane areas as your basic staple food, because the hurricanes leave them largely unaffected. They're mostly in valleys. So most of the hurricane gardens you build in the Pacific, you've got to include some of these plants in them, because after hurricanes like the last three in Fiji, there's no coconut crop in some islands for the next 10 years. So you've got to hang out somehow on the island without your staple food. And you want to think of your hurricane gardens in hurricane areas, put them in sheltered places, and put rootstock, rapid regenerating rootstock in them. Isolated islands, of which there are still many, have a lean time for about a decade after the coconuts are wiped out. Well, this is a very good group for your hurricane gardens. Right. That's one of the real water staples. The lotus then is the second one, and that's, I've forgotten its Latin name. Anybody help me? I'll think of it in a minute. Lotus is... It's in the water lily family. You know it, of course. I think you know it. It has an erect stem with a pink or blue flower and floating leaves, and has a very large rootstock, branched, and in section it's got those little holes through the root. And you slice the root and stir fry it. It's, you buy it a lot in cans, eh? You've seen it in your Chinese food sometimes.
Right.
Yeah, right. And also then this turns into a large fruit with little or large seeds sunk in little pits. And they're popped like popcorn. So secondarily it's a seed crop. And they're just like popcorn. So that's an emergent plant, and it enters into the seed. It's not ever grown purely for seed, and it's a staple root crop. In some areas, an awful lot of it is eaten in parts of China. It's particularly suitable for where you're reclaiming land from the sea, because it has quite a high degree of salt tolerance near the coast. So the Chinese use it as a pioneer crop for reclaimed land, or where you're pumping out lagoons in the mud of those lagoons. Yeah. Lotus? Well, the native one covers large areas in Australia, our lotus, our blue lotus. The other ones, usually just in the pond you put it in, as far as I know. Yeah.
But it will take
over. Well, they're also easily eliminated, lotus. You only have to cut them a few times and weaken them. So they're not known as a rampant species. They don't have a record of rampancy anywhere, lotus.
It's only
not in China,
is it?
Hey? No. They're so easily utilised that they're... they rot quickly too. Most of these things are cultivated plants. They're not known as rampant plants. If If there's one that goes rampant, I'll tell you. A lot of water plants do, but they're not the cultivated ones. One of the really important water plants in the greens, it's an anchored green, is Kangkong. All of these will grow in Perth, by the way. Kangkong is Ipomoea, sometimes known as water convolvulus. Ipomoea aquatica. It is often grown anchored. You'll see if you go along the little river waterways of Bangkok, you'll see bamboo stakes driven in with a pool of green around them, and it's Kangkong. They just bring a raft of it in, drive bamboo through it, and they use it to grab the silt to build up the base. And after you plant a Kangkong for a while and the silt settles in it, you get move into taro, and after you've grown taro for a while, you move into coconut. So it's a way you sort of stabilise riverbanks with Kangkong, taro, coconut sequences. You'll see them all in sequence throughout Bangkok or Asia. This is a very high quality green. It's got a high mineral and vitamin content. And it's a much more suitable green plant for the tropics than any of our cultivated greens like cabbages or beets or cauliflower. And it's pretty well pest-free. And it's strongly recommended where you're looking after nutrition in the tropics. Kangkong and its fellow, of course, is watercress, which has many of the same characteristics. It's a high nutrition green. It has a all year yield as greens, and it is pretty well pest free, so it's a really good, both of those are very good garden greens in the tropics and subtropics.
What about arid tropics?
Arid tropics, if you've got any water at all.
Yeah. Well, if you can establish the water on the ground.
Yes, if you had to choose between a couple of plants and you had a little pond about that big, with, say, a drip into it in arid tropics, you would use Kangkong in preference to almost any plant because of the quantity of its yield and its high-value food as a food. And it's propagated, basically it's propagated by divisions and just little sets. You cut bits off and put them in. Our watercress used to be called nasturtium. It's now called Rauripa aquatica, I think. Rauripa. They've changed its name of late. The tips and leaves all the time. Just to cut it all the time like watercress. Just clip it off, bundle it, and you'll see lots of it in the market. And the young stalks, whitey stalks. You'll often be in the market in the tropics and just see bundles of whitish or pinky coloured stalks with leaves on. It's almost always Kangkong. Just tied in bundles about that big. So they're important crops. Rice, of course, is emergent seed crop, and wild rice also is becoming important, which is a different plant altogether. Rice goes from mild temperate to tropical, and wild rice starts about the Arctic Circle and comes down to severe inland cold areas as far down south as would grow here, because it grows in Florida. Rice is a riser. That's rice. And wild rice is Zizania. They're both grasses, but they're totally different genera and unrelated. Zizania is a tall plant over my head with big spreading panicles of seed. Zizania lacustris is the one cultivated, meaning of the lakes. And of rice, there are a couple of species and thousands of varieties. including upland and dry area rices and the wet rices and long stalk rices for thatching, all sorts of rices. So Zinnia is the newest grain plant in cultivation. It's only been in cultivation 7 years. And it's grown in cold swamps or where there's a winter chill. It's an annual plant, but it self-seeds, so you don't need to replant it. And it's slowly increasing in area. It's another trouble-free plant. The problem with it is it ripens over 3 weeks. So unless you've got some intensive method of gathering it, you only get a very small proportion of the grain by mechanical harvesting. Rice, on the other hand, you get almost all the grain if you because it all ripens about the same time. It's an interesting crop, wild rice, and it's slowly starting to be transferred to the southern hemisphere. I brought some back and grew some down in Tasmania recently from the States. You can get it in from wild rice growers cooperatives in America. It comes through okay. There's no, customs thing about it. Just have to have it checked out for disease.
It's a better tolerant in cold climate than normal rice,
isn't it? For cold climates, it's your choice. Oh. Where rice stops, and you would have normally to go to rye or barley,
yeah.
You can also now go to wild rice, way out through Russia and those areas. Because of its long-term ripening. It's actually a very efficient grain producer. If you plant it in little tubes and plant it near your door, 100 plants will give you about 100 pounds of rice, which is very different from rice. But that means you're doing it intensively. But if you're harvesting it at one time, so the whole lot comes off and only part of it's ripe, half will have shattered and half will be unripened, then you're only getting about a very tiny percentage of it, probably about a 20th of the total crop. So you get about 800 pounds an acre as against 5,000 for rice. Although the wild rice, that's for harvesting by machine, the wild rice has greatly overproduced on rice. You can't get the seed. The Indians are efficient harvesters. They just canoe harvest every day for 3 weeks. So they get it all. But broadscale growers like to head it off, so they put in 1,000 acres and take a drop on yield just for the convenience of mechanical harvesting.
So what would it be like fruit trees then, as a way of fruit tree ripening? I mean,
yeah, exactly. It would be very analogous, say, to an orange tree. If you want to cut the orange tree off at any time,
yeah,
you're only going to get 1/100 of the oranges, yeah, that you can keep. But if you want to go and pick it or regularly harvest it, then you have to be able to move through it. So canoes can do that, machines can't. So the Indians still produce half of the total. There's only about 20 or 30 million pounds of it grown in the United States. It's so expensive because these machines cost such a huge amount. They're gigantic things. They're as big as this, room, wild rice harvester.
Did you run that
hydroponic? Yeah, they imitate Indians. They got dozens of little tin canoes out front and little beaters. It's like 100 Indians going through once, and of course the machine crushes all the bloody rice. So the Indians can't come through again, that's it. Weirdo stuff. Actually, there's another thing you can get it in Australia if you want to get it in. You'd have to go to your ag department, and if you're going to get it in here, I would get it in from Florida, because I would get it in from that area. It likes deepish water, about 18 inches. But to plant a small plot of it by hand, it's a very high production grain. If you just beat it each day, as before it's, so each ripe day the ripe seeds fall.
So actually, it's on the head and they ripen in different stages on the one head.
That's right, they do. It's unusual in its... That's right, the female panicle is right at the tip and the male one's down here, as against corn, in which the male panicle's up here and but they're both high on the plant. They're easily gathered and just beaten out in something and then let them stand up again. That's real easy to do. But you can't do that on a giant scale. But you can produce more off a quarter of an acre than you can off 10 acres of machine harvested rice. So it's, for a smallholder, it's a very, very high yielding crop.
What's the time span to get the earliest ripening to the latest ripening?
3 weeks. When you consider that an ordinary family's grain consumption, if they're grain-oriented, is only 240 pounds a year, quite obviously 500 wild rice plants totally satisfies that, and that's a tiny little plot. So you could eat wild rice all year if you wanted to.
How tolerant is it
to salt? Fairly tolerant. There are coastal varieties in Florida, because the inland ones are cold-tolerant. So you want to pick your provenance. Yeah, they don't use any. But so far, it hasn't.
Is it tolerant to pesticides that are already around?
I don't know about it. There are none used in the fields. The fields are very rich in crayfish and other things, which are sub-harvest. But typically, where it grows, you get otters, mink, crayfish, beavers, coyotes, all around it, and thousands of ducks and snow geese and that do the last harvest after the machines have finished. So it's a very rich animal.
Yeah.
In fact, the rice growers like to let them in after harvest. They don't fly into the standing crop, they can't land. But when you've pushed it down, they like them to come in to thin out the grain, otherwise the density of grain that regenerates is enormous, and they get a very crowded crop. Yeah, you don't really ever plant it again once you've planted it. You let the heads shatter. Some heads still will shatter into your pond, so you'll always get more. But if you're going to plant it, you bag the grain and keep it in a refrigerator underwater all winter in a bag, or in a pond, frozen pond all winter, and then just distribute it in the spring. It needs that winter chill.
Does it need running water, or doesn't need
No, it's a still pond thing. It's marsh margins and or lake margins and paddy fields made for it that flooded to 15 inches at maturity. Yeah, and then it drained it 3 weeks before they harvested to get the machinery on there. So that's another innovative aquaculture that's spreading and is... I love the whole situation. There are very big buns and in the rice field, and these drains are always full of burrowing crayfish, cambaras types like our yabbies. It's crayfish, and then there's mink get in here, and nutria, all sorts of little fur animals burrow in the banks, and there's always millions of ducks over the fields, wild rice itself. The crayfish eat the greens out to about there, otherwise they don't affect the crop. And these guys eat the crayfish, and then there's beavers, they always do a little bit in here, damming up the drains. So the whole thing's really delightful wildlife area too. In fact, the first wild rice grain was grown only for wildlife, several thousand acres of it was developed to stage wildlife on their migration routes down through the United States. And it was in the guys that got involved in growing for wildlife who split off and started to grow it and harvest it as a commercial crop. The Jacobs brothers of Mill Luck in Wisconsin were originally wildlife management people, and they're very tolerant of the wildlife. So there's one thing I think would harvest it better than the machines. It's a pack rat. While I was up there, they had trouble with a diesel engine, and we looked at the manifold and it was full of clean wild rice seeds at ideal ripeness, and there must have been about 100 pounds of wild rice stuck in this engine manifold. And we found a pack rat sitting out in front of it, and he plugged the end of it with the fluff off the typha off the bull rush, and he's in this little cosy typha fluff nest with the 100 pounds of... Well, I said, there's your harvesting system. Just put up manifolds in the field, you know. And he just keeps harvesting. I mean, he harvests just only sound seed, only ripe seed, and he husks it and puts it away. So, I mean, what do you want machines for? One of the Jacobs looked at me and he looked at there. He said, he could be right. Because these are the most efficient harvesters.
What are they?
Pack rats. They have big cheek pouches. They, they're really the capitalists of the rodent world. They never know when they've got enough. As long as there's food, they're stacking it. And they've got these big cheek pouches like this, you know. And they go and fill them all up, husk all these little things, put them in their cheek pouches and go and put them in their little dry burrows, dry them out, stir them around, store them for the winter. But it's estimated the pack rats and squirrel only need 15% of the food they store. So you have a manifold of which 15% belongs to the fat rat, pack rat, 85% yours. Like most capitalists, you know, they can't stop collecting money. It's just, they've just got to fill up the holes, you know. Right. So there's another fascinating plant. there are many, many other plants. When you, I have somewhere with me some lists I brought up in which the plants of the wetlands are listed. There's a prickly plant grown in India just for a seed crop, which we don't grow at all, rather like a lotus. All sorts of water plants being grown. Really, water culture hasn't been a big part of Western culture. So we've missed out on a lot of goodies. In the anchored plants, you've got the... it's a starchy crop. You've got the Indian water chestnut. It's a beautiful food. It's a trapa. Natans is one of them, but there's a lot of other trapa. There are 9 species. And they grow from cool, temperate to tropical areas. They're an anchored plant. They grow in about 30 inches, 2/3, 60 centimetres of water. And they anchor. And they have very large, mealy seeds up here, shaped like this. So they're called bicornis or tricornis. What are those things the Romans used to throw under the hooves of horses that had spikes on it set up? Special name.
Similar to a double G.
Like a double G. Wouldn't it? No matter which way it lands, there's always a spike up. They had a name. Anyhow, one of the species names is after that. That's soft green. It's not really prickly. And just break it open with your fingers and there's this big, white, crisp chestnut inside, water chestnut, called Zingala in northern India. And it's a great culture, Zingala culture. In fact, in India, when I was there in 1576, I think it was, a quarter acre pond rented at... $900 Australian per year, which is a lot of money, just to be allowed to grow it, Singala, and they made a lot of money from a quarter of an acre of that. And I love that culture because the ladies have all these great big beaten copper bowls that float on the water, and their saris, and it's about that deep, and they... they're going around picking the Singara and floating them over to you in copper bowls. It's just worth paying for the food just to watch it all happening. It's nice, it's graceful, it's really good. You'd sell a bulk of those if you had a couple of Indian ladies and saris in the Singara pond by the highway. You just have car crashes everywhere, you know. Their silk and their graceful movements. Yeah. Yes, it's in Australia. It's a native of Australia too. It's almost throughout the world. You would probably need to get the Italian form, which is widely grown in Italy, to get the best form, say, for Perth. It's the Italian form that was named after those those horse crippling things they used to make. I don't know what they're called now.
So I do. The trapper is the water chestnut, is it?
Trapper.
Trapper.
Yeah. Trapper natans, or trapper bicornis, or trapper types. There's 9 species of it. So that's an excellent starch crop. And then a quite different plant, which is strongly emergent starch crop, is the Chinese water chestnut, which is grown in Australia. I don't know whether you buy it here in the markets. Certainly it comes on the Sydney markets about April, which is... I better start cleaning my board sometimes. Chinese water chestnut is Rush, Eleocharis. And I think this one's Esculenta or Bulbifera or both. I think both of those are grown. And they are a simple cylindrical rush with a large root, and then it sends out runners and roots form on them like that, and about that big, little hard round ones, and just slip the skins off, and they have exactly the same texture as the Indian water chestnuts. They're crisp. You buy these in cans and you find those little white things cut up in Chinese food. That's the Chinese water chestnut, the Eleocharis. Fresh in the markets about April to May in New South Wales. Increasingly being grown in New South Wales as a minor crop, because you've only got the Asian market to satisfy. All the Chinese in Sydney get their water chestnuts delivered almost to the door by the growers. So. Or to a Chinese market where they have easy access for it. Mm. They're 2 seasonal crops, both of which can extremely well, because neither Eleocharis nor Trapper loses its crispness. They're always crisp, whether they're canned or eaten raw or cooked. And for that, they're very valued. Otherwise, they have about the same value as most starch foods. Eleocharis has another and interesting characteristic. It's basically a bactericide. And one of these crushed will purify about 1 litre of water from E. coli in about 20 minutes. So a stand of Eleocharis will also do a much better job on E. coli and say it's got a better purification than, say, chlorine has. It eats the E. coli, I think, too. The plant, after it, I think it stuns them and eats them. Yeah. So it's got that, and if you're wandering at large and you've got a pocket full of these guys and squeeze them into your water, you're pretty right for most infectious diseases, I think, except, I think, some worm eggs. It kills most of the... things that worry us. It's just a side thing on that. Then on you go. Now, the thing is, there is an important and increasingly grown and good lot of plants to grow in water, which we haven't been growing much. The only one we've really tackled is rice on the broad scale. The rest of it. But you'll see increasingly more and more... I'm noticing the taro patch is increasing in northern New South Wales. You just see a few plants in gardens, and there you'll see little patches of 1/8 acre, sometimes 1/4 acre, all through New South Wales, probably due to the fact we've had a lot of Maori people over recently and some Solomon Islanders, and so they're spreading the taro growing. And the Chinese grow a lot of taro, and so do the Indonesians grow taro amongst the rice and so on. So, and the Vietnamese grow a lot of taro, Thais. Of course, you get Fijians in, he doesn't like taro, he likes that alocasia, which everybody thinks is a very inferior crop unless you're Fijian. See, what you grow up to, what you eat when you're tiny, becomes your food preference. And The Fijians eat ufi, while the Hawaiians eat taro, and the Tahitians eat breadfruit. And all those who don't eat it despise it, like breadfruit's fed to pigs in Hawaii, and taro's fed to pigs in Tahiti, and both are fed to pigs in Fiji, where they eat the alakazia, which is really a very inferior root crop, very fibrous. Gives them those big, strong teeth, though it's terribly more fibrous than the other crops. So you get your food preferences very young, and you can't alter them. You can't go there and say, oh, we'll get much better crop of taro. Yeah, well, that's for pigs, you know. You have a job altering those food preferences. You can alter them by something unrelated. Oh, yeah. My trouble's potatoes. I'm stuck on the potato. Actually, I eat all these things and enjoy them, so I've learnt to generalise. Cut loose from your roots, you probably can eat anything. After all, if you don't grow anything and live in the city, you'll eat anything, I reckon. You don't have any tradition of food from the garden. The point that I'm trying to make is that there are a tremendous number, we've only just subsampled them a little bit, of water-related plants for us to grow. And some have very, very special uses unrelated to food, medicinal and other uses. And then there are a whole lot of marginal plants, plants in the margins. We plant on the margins of ponds. Traditionally, the Chinese put here the mulberry for two reasons, probably. One is intrinsic yield of the mulberry, which is A, silk, and increasingly now grown purely medicinally for interferon, which comes from the silkworm. More silkworms are being grown for medicinal production of interferon than they are in cancer, than they are, or generally in immune defence, than they are for being grown for silk today. They're grown on the mulberry and they're grown over ponds, usually on the white mulberry, but any mulberry does. You can grow silkworms too on your castor oil plants. There's a silkworm grows on that, one of the silkworms. But the important thing to the Chinese is a rain of feces from the silkworms, which are eaten by their grass carp. So it's a first stage digestion of the mulberry leaf, and the mulberry leaves are also eaten by quite a lot of water organisms, and the mulberries eaten by almost all fish, including trout. The intrinsic yield of the mulberry tree, which is fine timber and it's silk and mulberries, and then the secondary yields in the water from the mulberry trees. So it's become, as long ago as 1100 BC, some emperors laying down the rules for growing fish in ponds, and at that point he said, and then you live set mulberry right around the border of your pond for silkworms and so on. So it's an ancient border plant. Then there's a whole lot of plants like our tea trees, our Leptosperma and Melaleucas, which are a high quality insect attracting trees in blossom, and they yield a lot of insect life to the water surface and produce honey. And also they produce a very fine brush in the water on which a lot of fish spawn, and a lot of crustacea hide in them, a lot of shrimp. And whitebait spawn on them too, at least in Tasmania. So if you remove the tea trees, effectively you remove the whitebait. It's amazing how quickly you drop the productivity of a river or a pond by clearing the tea tree or the marginal plants. Jewel beetles in particular will actually sheet the water when the tea tree is flowering, so you can get, when the winds blow, you can get, at home anyhow, you can get big drifts of jewel beetles probably 2 feet deep and 3 or 4 feet across, washed off the lake surfaces. When they missed their step, fly into the tea trees, decide to land on the water. Trout are very fat at that time. To stress the importance of those flying insect foods to the fish, they have a 1:1.8 conversion from dual petal into fish. So that's a high, very high value fish food, and you can get thousands of pounds of jewel beetles falling on a quite small lake. So you get a lot of fish out of that. And you can't eat the jewel beetles, they're a bit crunchy, but you can eat the fish at a fairly efficient conversion rate. And that's as good a conversion rate as you'll get with any food. So insects are very important food. So there's those reasons for pond margins. The shade given to fish in hot weather, the relief from high temperatures and shallows, important function of the marginal plants.